You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
The Huru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great White North, and we came out of the box today with the music of Delaine Brown, Until We're Free. This is October, and we're still celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Black Panther Party, and I would like to thank two people, like I thank every week. I would like to thank Chairman Omali Ishatella and Archie Shepp. Chairman Omali Ishatella gave me the space on Uhuru Radio to do diasporic music, and Archie Shepp gave me the concept of diasporic music, music made in the West, but not of the West. We have some great people on the show today. We're going to be speaking with John Whitford, the former editor of Muhammad Speaks, and he's going to be speaking about a book on Richard Doran called Word Warrior. But right now, we wanted to play some music from Ann Peebles, the Young Hearts, and the SOS Band. We are playing Ann Peebles because one of the men who wrote this song, Earl Randall, he went to Los Angeles City College with Al Prentice Bunchy Carter. The Young Hearts, Al Prentice Bunchy Carter, Elaine Brown, and John Huggins used to sing I've Got Love for My Baby. They changed the words to I Got Love for My People. And the SOS Band was produced, and this song was written and produced by Sagidi Abdullah, who knew Al Prentice Bunchy Carter. And Al Prentice Bunchy Carter put on a talent show at Los Angeles City College. And Sagidi Abdullah knew Al Prentice Bunchy Carter. So we're going to listen to Ann Peebles, Young Hearts, and the SOS Band.
Mm-hmm. charm every girl you see, and play with everyone that you can. But I've got news for you. I hope it won't hit you too hard. One of these days, while you're at play, I'm gonna catch you off guard. I'm gonna tear your playhouse down. Pretty soon, I'm gonna tear your just fun and games, trying to be a playboy. All you do is run around, using hearts for play toys. You've been playing daddy with every mama around. What you gonna play? Your playhouse tumbling down. I'm gonna tear playhouse down. Pretty soon I'm gonna tear your playhouse down, room by room. I'm gonna tear your playhouse down.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. And on the line with me is John Woodford. John Woodford was born in Chicago and grew up in Benton Harbor, Michigan. Woodford earned his B.A. and M.A. from Harvard University. His journalism jobs have included editor-in-chief of Muhammad Speaks newspaper and executive editor of the University of Michigan's alumni publication, Michigan Now. He contributed to the Black Scholar and Against the Current journals. He resides in Ann Arbor, Michigan, USA, with his wife Elizabeth, and has three grown children and four grandchildren. How are you doing today?
Okay, fine. Thank you very much for inviting me on your show.
I guess that the first thing you want to talk about is the fact that your Chicago Cubs are going to they won the pennant, I guess, for the first time in 78 years, and they're going to go to the World Series for the first time in a century.
That's right. I grew up right across the lake from Chicago, so that was our closest big league city. And so the Cubs and the Bears were teams I liked from as a little kid, even grade school. So, yeah, back in the late 40s, listening to the Cubs, at least since 47 or 8. And
all right, but
I didn't, you know, they got, here they are. They're going to go to the pennant. So that's something.
But I guess we're here to talk about, I want to hear your thoughts on Sonia D. Williams' book, Word Warrior, Richard Durham, Radio and Freedom.
Yes, well, talk about Chicago. Richard Durham came to Chicago. His family moved up from Mississippi. And Sonia has done a tremendous job in unearthing the story of a great literary man who probably would have otherwise been ignored. He was early in radio. He wrote dramas. He wrote poetry. And he wrote the first black soap opera. He used to write for soap operas and radio plays. He worked for union publications. And the first black TV soap opera, Bird of the Iron Feather, he wrote that. And then he was the main writer for Muhammad Ali's autobiography. the greatest, also some of the things he did. And he was, you know, this was a time when people could grow up and during the Depression and after the Depression with the Roosevelt administration, when the federal government was relatively progressive, probably more than it has otherwise been, and they funded writing programs and other things. You know, nowadays we can hardly get them to contribute to our so-called national public radio and TV stations, and you got right-wingers controlling the content. But back then it was a lot different, you know, because they had the World War II and post-World War II efforts. And so many progressive people learned a lot of skills during that time, and he was one of them. He worked with Studs Terkel and, oh, you know, a bunch of other writers, Chicago area writers. They had young people's writing programs, drama programs. So he developed that, and he, you know, he was then went on to write for Lone Ranger and Suspense. That was a radio program back in the day. Old Ma Perkins. He worked as a script doctor. So, you know, he had a great dramatic sense of drama in his writing, powerful writing. So one of the things he pointed out, and one of the things that animates his work is, let me quote this here, I'm going to get it right. He said, somewhere in this ocean of, he said Negro at the time, but he would have stopped using that term, somewhere in this ocean of African-American life, with its cross currents and undercurrents, lies the very soul of America. It lies there because the real life story of a single black man in Alabama walking into a voting booth across a Ku Klux Klan line has more drama and world implications than all the stereotypes Hollywood or radio can turn out in 1,000 years. So I think that's a good pithy statement of how he sensed of using dramatic situations with regular people and his insights. People who lived obscure lives and resisted, fought. His main thing was to show people fighting back against racism and bigotry was kind of that's what kept him going in drama and in journalism. So
I don't want to cut you, but you mentioned Oscar Brown Jr. Now that was a man that. If we know anything about Oscar Brown Jr., we know that he did the 40 Acres and the Mule, and he was If you know anything about Richard Pryor, that's where Richard Pryor got a lot of his stuff from. But he met Richard Durham when he was 18 years old.
Right. They were both kids, and they were lifelong friends. And Durham, at the newspaper where I knew him, Durham was a person who, let's say, he was very much there on the job, but then when he left, he had his other life of dealing with dramas and other plans that we didn't necessarily know about. You know, we were kind of kids, and he was bringing us along, but he wasn't one to tip his hand about what he was doing until it was sewed up and done. So we didn't know about a lot of his movie and book and other kinds of plans that he had, or even his dramas, till the contract was there. He worked for NBC during the period when the McCarthyite period. They tried to squeeze the progressive writers out of the radio because they realized that there was content in the programs that they didn't like. So. He sued NBC for underpaying him and other black writers and producers. This is back in the 50s, you know. And they were using his scripts without his approval. And this was at a time when he was just had a newborn, his only child was born. Yet he risked his, this is about, you know, late 40s. but he took the stand, and I think they the case made it into the courts for 4 or 5 years and settled, and he couldn't go back to NBC. He also couldn't say what the terms of settlement were, but I think he probably whipped him.
Mm-hmm.
In that, that's one of the earliest cases of you know, discrimination connected with the arts. So that's when he went to work for the Packing House Workers of America Union, where a lot of people could kind of get a shelter during the McCarthy period by through progressive labor unions. And that's why he left the radio, network radio, to become kind of a PR and publicist and editor of the Packing House Worker.
How long did he last with the Packing House Worker?
Let's see. He probably lasted 2 or 3 years, maybe 4 or 5. He sided with a left-wing challenger to the leader. They had a, it's just like court politics. He went with the side that lost out in the election. So the guy who was the head of the union forced the people who were with the other person to leave the union. But he was one of the early ones then to fight for equal pay for women in the union. This is also back in the 50s. And that's all told about in the book, too. He encouraged the women to get their information together and do their caucusing and fighting, and they succeeded. And I think in the book it says how Addie Wyatt, who started working on the meatpacking floor, became a vice president of the union. And she said it was his fight for her and other women that inspired her to get in there and tussle, and she rose high in the union. She always said, he was not fearful of our struggle. He embraced it.
Also, Margaret Burroughs.
That was just that one level of his work.
Margaret Burroughs spoke highly of him, right?
Oh, yeah, you bet. One of the founders of the DuSable Museum. African American history. Yeah, they were.
She eulogized him, right?
Yes. They grew up at a time when being a lefty and working with communist and socialist parties and groups was, you might say, not an abnormal thing in the country. It might be something akin to the way it is in Europe or South America or Africa or other places that have a more mature sense of politics than this country, right now at least. In the last several decades, a lot of that's being they try to obliterate it from the history, and that's what's so great about this book is if you look at the book and then wonder why you may not have heard of any of these things that were going on back then and why they wouldn't be even in the black history courses, let alone in the main history, you can get a sense of areas of our life and struggle that you have to dig for yourself to find out about, because it's not going to be in any mainstream, even the mainstream that's relatively controlled by liberals, this won't be in there.
Now, I wanted to ask you, I don't want you to fast forward, but as if we only have about 20-something minutes,
we have
20 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you about, he became the editor of Muhammad Speaks, so you followed him as the editor of the Muhammad Speaks, but I wanted to ask you about the black press. We had the Negro World, which was the official organ of the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League. Now, they were they put out a daily for, I think, two and a half years. They also were publishing French and English and Spanish. Then we had Muhammad Speaks, and we had the Black Panther newspaper. And those three newspapers had the biggest circulations of any black newspapers historically. And even today, I don't think there's anything that has topped Muhammad Speaks, the Negro World, or the Black Panther paper. Could you talk about,
we've seen in this country, unlike most of the rest of the world, developed and even underdeveloped, reading newspapers, written press, where you can get your daily news and have the reporters out. And, you know, it's shrunk in this country. We've got all these online things, but what's happened is, I think this means it's an atomized readership, disjointed, disorganized, unorganized, and consequently, public opinion is valued more as a marketing phenomenon than even as a political one, except as, of course, elections, which are almost like a marketing exercise here, rather than political. But yeah, people don't know what's going on. We don't know what's going on in our hometown here. We're in Ann Arbor, Michigan, a very well-to-do community with a big university. We have a paper that comes out in paper only 2 days a week.
Two days a week,
and has hardly any of our local news in it. It's very hard to know what's going on in your town if you don't have a newspaper, especially if you have a sizable town and you don't. If you have only a weekly, let alone or 2 days a week, you need a daily newspaper. But the fact that we don't have one shows that it's money forces. You know, they're much more interested in online things, and they can. They can tell you what's at the movie and who the performers are coming to town, and that kind of thing, where the sales are. But news content, no. And look at the readership in the major daily newspapers all across the country. The newspapers aren't valued because they were, unfortunately, mainly propped up a lot by ads and marketing. So now you can see, as you might say, the daily press journalism is hoist on its own petard, you know, as Shakespeare might say. In other words, they're blown up by their own firecracker. I mean, they have the very reasons that they expanded with the ads and commercial mentality, that now that's bringing it down, because those people have moved on with their money because they're more interested in ads and making money than they are in information, news. So all the papers, the major papers, are hanging on by the skin of their teeth. And the black papers, of course, most of them either died or shrunk to near nothing. A lot of them are now not owned by black owners anymore. And maybe you can get your church news and what's on sale, but you don't get much news. These papers used to be very, very influential, the Chicago Defender and Michigan Chronicle, and you know, all across the Cleveland Column Post, all across the country, there were black newspapers that could have an independent line, especially on race matters. And
John, could you talk about the content of Muhammad Speaks? When I was growing up, I used to read the Muhammad Speaks, and I remember a guy by the name of Charles P. Howard, who wrote about international issues. I remember learning, Kwame Nkrumah from Ghana would write for them from time to time. Could you talk about the fact that the Muhammad Speaks, the Black Panther Party, and I wasn't too young for the Negro World, but those, but we're talking specifically about Muhammad Speaks. Could you talk about some of the columnists and how they covered Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and for lack of a better word, the band down world?
Yeah, well, Charles P. Howard should have been it's too bad. A lot of papers carried him, but I think that they were leaned on not to carry him when it come time to war, because Charles P. Howard would expose he was an anti-imperialist, just to put it bluntly. He did not support U.S. imperialism, you know, my country right or wrong. So if my country wants to go jump on a colony and keep it a colony, or invade a country in the name of so-called stability because they have a resource, a natural resource they wanted. Well, he exposed all that stuff. And he would interview people who informed people from those countries. So I would say that the readership of Muhammad Speaks and these other papers, they would know more about the reasons that you wouldn't want to be fighting in the Vietnam War, say, than you were likely to get in the regular mass media for quite some years. And the same would go for things like Cuba or, you know, the Congo crisis, South African apartheid. All of those things were covered in these black papers much more regularly, closely and objectively, with no slant from the State Department. Now, when I worked for the New York Times, you could see that when the people, all the foreign correspondents would come back, and they were all debriefed. They would be debriefed in Washington, often before coming back to their desks when they came back. So there's a lot of intelligence, government intelligence work going on with some members of the big media. And that's why you see now, look at the coverage of Syria, where you think there's a boogeyman and leading Syria, and another, and the boogeyman Russian is helping the boogeyman Syria. I mean, this is, let's put it this way. They're bombing Yemen now. They've been bombing in Iraq. They bombed Libya. They bombed all over. You'll see a picture of a four-year-old in Syria, and they say, oh, you know, they saw this, so shocking. They killed a four-year-old in a bombing there. You could show that same picture from all these other places where the U.S. is doing the bombing, but you notice they don't show it. But that's the way our regular mass big media works. They're shaping a story. Hillary Clinton's talking about a no-fly zone, which would be an act of war in Syria. And when you look at what they've been doing, they are knocking off, not that all of these people are wonderful people, but they're no worse than the people that the United States has been supporting, but they're knocking off the more secular leaders in the Muslim and Arab world, and in places where they have usually oil or some other resource, but usually it's oil, and that's what they're up to. And it's, if they keep doing the same thing and they say, oops, look, oh, Iraq's a mess, Libya's a mess, Afghanistan's a mess, all these places they go into wind up being messes, and the places where they weren't such a mess, like Syria wasn't such a mess, they undermined it, and they sent weapons to the same sorts of people that they gave the weapons to in Afghanistan, who turned out to be the Taliban. I mean, you don't have to be a genius to figure out that these things can't happen by mistake. This is obviously what's intended. If they can install an effective puppet, so be it. If they can't and they just create chaos, civil war, instability, they always say it's for stability, but it's really for instability. And governments like that in Israel right now and other places are the ones advocating, and I think that's why Hillary Clinton and some of these other so-called liberal Democrats, they're really are talking like hawks, is because there's some sort of pro-Israel and what other kind of money and oil is involved with it, but those are the ones that obviously want these secular Arab and Muslim leaders out of the way. And people can try to figure out what it is about them that would make them want them out of the way, and they would rather have the fundamentalists ruling these countries, the more backward ones.
Let me ask you, how do you rate Sonya D. Williams' book when it comes to covering? Do you think she had to back off of anything, or do you think she really told it like it was and is?
I think she told as much as she could find out, and as much as she was sensitive to. In other words, I don't think she's necessarily mainly. I mean, she's an expert on some of the arts and journalism and issues of that sort, and she covered it. But I think it was a very courageous book. I mean, it was courageous to take this up as a topic, and I applaud her for it. And she did a great job in the topic, and not. You'll see a lot of books, say some books about Paul Robeson or various others. You'll see that someone will say that maybe they lost their minds and that made them go to the left. I mean, one of the tropes in U.S. So-called liberal points of view is that those who were to the left, especially if they were socialists or communists, it was some sign of some mental problems. Either they're brainwashed or something's wrong with them. She didn't take that opportunistic line whatsoever. She showed the strength that Durham and Oscar Brown Jr. and all those other people gained by their association, which was based on principles. It wasn't, for working people having the power to unite, anti-racist, and anti-imperialist wars. Those are the principles. So she shows that. So I'm all for her. I think she's I can't fault anything that she did. I don't know of any kind of information that she might have had that I don't think she would have held any critical thing back. She makes no she doesn't condemn Durham in any way whatsoever for any of his associations. And yet she shows some aspects of his. You know, he had a lot of tension. He died early. I think he was highly stressed. He was playing. He had that newspaper. He's the one who made the ties, not only with Charles P. Howard, but there were a lot of ties with progressive people in the United Nations that Durham forged. And I think in this country, it's hard for a person to bring that off without having some kind of a career and other kinds of pressures. You know, he had bad blood pressure and other problems. He keeled over in his, how old was he? Maybe.
60, about 60, 66 maybe?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, yeah.
Well, let me say that.
No, I think it's a yeah. What do you think? What do you think about the book?
It's a great book in terms of I didn't know about all of the first of all, you know, it shows that a for lack of a better word, a Negro from Mississippi could be so rebellious, and you know those stereotype of the Black person from the South, in particular,
right.
Mississippi, or the Mississippi Blacks are supposed to be the most backward set of people on the planet Earth. And, you know, reading this particular book, I mean, you get a sense of that, you know, Richard Durham's father owned land. He went to, you know, his mother was very entrepreneurial. The family stuck together.
Well, they were for education. They did it. They sacrificed for education, and you know, even if they didn't, a lot of the people from Mississippi, even if they didn't own land, they came up and they were really a key part of progressive politics. You know, one thing Durham said, I think it was another critical statement. He said there are times when any man may be written as humble, but with the Negro, it's simply overworked, phony. And in some cases,
a
perversion.
Right.
A good many white people have cushioned themselves into dreaming that Negroes are not self-assertive, confident, and never leave the realm of fear or subservience. To portray them as they are will give a greater education than a dozen lectures. So there again is its principle in drama. Portray the people as they are. You know, I'm looking at some of these movies that we've got out now, and the portrayal of the of black people in the movies. And this is, there's a new twist to them, but it's as pitiful as ever. You see all these people usually cringing and crying, and you know, the I think poor she's a great actress, Viola Davis, but every time I see her, she's got to have, when she goes for an Oscar, she lets snot come out of her nose, you know, weeping and wailing. That's the new stereotype. And then you got the cringing, weeping black man is one of the things you see them doing. Well, you know, if I could get a picture of all the wailing, cringing black male figures I've seen in the recent movies, I could probably make a documentary that would last at least an hour long just by having three or four or five seconds cuts of them. Crazy, the eye rolling stuff. You see this, you know, this underground or these new ones that are on about rap music, Empire and these things. They have some stereotypes in there that are, it's like a self-inflicted wound. A lot of them have black writers, and you think they have some kind of control and some sense of the effect on their viewers, especially young ones, to think that this is a portrayal of black men and women as they are really in the world. And after a while, well, of course, people start imitating. Yeah, go ahead. You interrupt me anytime.
No, go ahead. I cut you off.
Oh, I'm just going to say that after a while, you know, people imitate what they see in some of these programs, and they think that then is the authentic, natural black culture. So you'll see, the women behaving in a certain way towards the men and vice versa, and all this kind of low talk all the time, round the clock. It gets picked up by children. It's very powerful.
Well, you know, I'm speaking with John Woodford, former editor-in-chief of Muhammad Speaks. Now, I would like to speak, I'd like to talk a few minutes about Richard Doohan's radio work. Now, I think we're down to, we don't own any, when I say we, black people, the fact we, the newspaper situation has been decimated. We have a few internet radio stations, like we have, we're speaking on internet radio. This is Uhuru Radio, and Uhuru Radio is getting ready to get a license, you know, I guess a low power license for, for St. Petersburg, Florida. But could you talk about the fact that Richard Doohan was a pioneer in the radio work in terms of he did series about African people, and he was able to break through where I think he wrote for the Lone Ranger.
Yes, he did. And the thing about it is he understood that, you know, another thing he did, he wrote historical dramas too, which were big back then. And
Didn't he do something on Nat Turner?
Yeah. He knew how to shape historical drama to Crispus Attucks. I don't know about Nat Turner, Sojourner Truth. I'm not sure about Nat Turner, but I know about the others. And he would be able to, that's one of the reasons I think he finally got eased off the radio. But he always said you could do it in Aesopian. In other words, it's like a fable. There's a moral to the story, and the dedicated writer shapes the moral as he or she sees fit to convey something to regular people, regular listeners. So that's what he did with those radio plays. And you have to be a very adroit writer of dialogue to do that. He wrote, maybe people can go online now and check out the radio serial. It was called Destination Freedom. Destination Freedom. And he also had, there was one called Democracy USA. There was another one called Here Comes Tomorrow. And that was the first radio serial about a black American family. And mm-hmm. he did that, yeah, too.
He did Denmark Vesey, and he did a piece on Denmark Vesey.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Yeah, uh huh. So he knew how to set the people into a drama and have the villains, you know, shape up the villainy and shape up the heroism, and show the issues in such a way that people could tell in what way their own lives pose similar problems. And so that's going to inspire people to fight back in their own lives. I think that's why Addie Wyatt and the people in the Packing House Union liked him so much, because he could break it down and he could make the people, you know, he could make you feel bigger than you were or thought you were. And that's what he did with the people on his staff. Now, yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're running out of time, and I want you to talk about his work with Muhammad Ali and his work with Harold Washington.
Ah, yeah, well, he was a behind-the-scenes advisor to Harold Washington on how he should, you know, the kind of way he should present himself to try to win a majority vote in a city like Chicago. In other words, you look at your forces. You don't have enough winning just your own people. You've got to have a way to appeal to others and what you say and how you run your campaign. I think he advised him in that score, and he was successful. And the other one, Muhammad Ali. Well, of course, he wanted Muhammad Ali to go to college. He saw how, you know, what a smart person, but undereducated, because Muhammad Ali didn't pay much attention in school. And he had certain, I think, learning disabilities that probably came from that. He didn't pay that much attention, but he was very much interested in learning. So when he was banned by Elijah after he supported, after he didn't go into the war, and he wanted to separate him from Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali wanted him to go to, I think it was Texas Southern or some kind of place. I think it was Texas Southern.
Durham wanted Muhammad Ali to go to Texas.
Yeah,
he's talking about Durham.
Yeah, Durham was trying to get him to, you know, go down, take courses, sharpen up your reading, because Muhammad Ali had was sort of like a restless, untrained intelligence. And Durham thought, well, if he could ever, he could learn things, but it was, he didn't tend to learn it through reading. That's why he was always doing magic tricks and things like that to try to use his wits, but in the poetry he wrote, many of which are really wonderful poems. But Durham thought if he ever got more education, he would have been an even more powerful, influential figure. But other people wanted him. He was earning a lot of money for those who had the boxing licenses. And I think it was impossible for him to break away from that.
Where did he go with Ali in terms of other parts? He went to Congo. It was Zaire at that time, but Congo. What are some of the places that they traveled together?
Oh, they traveled all over the place. All over the place. Because while he was working on the autobiography, The Greatest, wherever Ali went, you'd go with him. So they, I don't know how many places, West Indies, Africa, I don't know about South America. I mean, Ali went so many places back then. I mean, Durham didn't travel with him every trip. It would have worn him out. But he used to go all over the place, and they just hung out. He was very close. He really respected Durham. He knew that Durham wasn't trying to exploit him. Durham had his own development, his own intellectual development at heart. That's what Durham was hoping for. And the Durham recognized what a, you know, what a courageous and influential person he was anyway. Yeah, he really loved Muhammad Ali.
He also took his son. Durham took his son with him too, right?
Durham took his son with him.
Yes, Durham's son.
Oh, Mark?
Mark spent a lot of time with him in Zaire.
Mark was?
Yes.
I didn't know about that. You know, as a matter of fact, boy, it might be nice if you could interview Mark sometime. I only met Mark briefly once because he was away at college. He was the apple of his dad's eye. And his dad especially liked because he's a very accomplished jazz musician and a writer on his own. I don't know what field he went into because I left Chicago before he got back. So, and Durham compartmentalized. Durham often would bring, say, now Joe Walker was our great New York editor and correspondent. If Joe came to visit Durham, Durham would meet Joe out at a bar someplace else. He wouldn't bring him into the office because, you know, he had a sense that let there be no collusion undermining his authority. So, so Joe would later say, "I came in. Joe would say, I never got to go to the office to see you guys. Dick would always take me somewhere else." he was a very complicated, sharp person. He's dealing with a bunch of young goofball black men who he had to keep him. He knew how to keep them in line without being. He was never hard. He was disciplined, but he was aloof in a tactical kind of way, you know, how you're going to run people. Okay. You don't buddy up to them.
All right, John. We only have about 2 minutes left. I'd like to.
Okay. I want to say how lucky the people up there are to have a radio program like yours. It's really something. We don't have anything like this around here that I know of. We got some jive program in Detroit. I hear sometimes that not talking about much serious or seriously, but it's impressive. I was almost hoping that Trump would win, so I have an excuse to move to Canada.
it doesn't look like he's going to win now.
No, I have to say it's based on music here. Well, that's okay. Yeah, he'd be a. It's that would be a dreadful situation if that element was strong enough to elect someone. I mean, the fact that they were strong enough to even, we'll see how many they get. But I think the number of low-minded people in the country will find out whether they are above 25% or 30% or not.
All right, Mr. Woodford, thank you very much. We'll definitely have you back on sooner than later.
Yeah. Okay, well, I hope your readers will, especially those interested in history of black journalism and black culture in general in the United States, will take a look at that book, especially those
and
in
the
school.
And the book is, go ahead.
The Word Warrior by Sonia Williams. Word Warrior, and a very apt title. It shows how people can fight with words.
All right, sir. Thank you very much.
All right. We'll see you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks to
your staff.
All right.
Yep. Bye.
All right. Thank you. And we have been speaking with John Woodford, former editor of Muhammad Speaks, and Diasporic Music continues on Uhuru Radio.
The real reason for all of this... Uhuru Radio.
Black power in black community.
McKinney Clemente up in the Green Party. No disrespect, we need a rare black and green party.
Informative.
How wealth gets redistributed is that the workers themselves come to power. The workers come to power and then we redistribute the wealth, not the petty bourgeoisie.
No degrading lyrics. Finally, the station you've been looking for, Uhuru Radio.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, the bluesologist based in Toronto, Canada, and we're getting ready to listen to Maurice Bishop's speech that he made at Hunter College on June 5th, 1983. And Ilombe Brass has reminded us that U.S. imperialism invaded 111 countries before the Russian Revolution in 1917. And we're going to listen to Maurice Bishop. We're going to listen to three clips from Maurice Bishop, but let's listen to Maurice Bishop and talk a little bit about Maurice Bishop, who was assassinated on October 19th, 1983.
The real reason for all of this hostility is because some perceive that what is happening in Grenada can lay the basis for a new socio-economic and political response. Kinds of reasons and excuses, some of them credible, some utter rubbish. There's an interesting one that we saw very recently in a secret report of the State Department. I want to tell you about that one, so you can reflect on that one. That secret report made this point, that Grenada is different to Cuba and Nicaragua, and the Grenada Revolution is in one sense even worse, using their language, than the Cuban and Nicaraguan revolutions, because the people of Grenada and the leadership of Grenada speaks English, yes, and therefore can communicate directly.
your report clearly is one of the more sensible ones.
The people of Grenada rose with dignity, rose up from oppression, rose up from iniquity and shame, from the darkness of desecration, shaking up paralysis of corruption, tyranny, violence and subjugation, to shine down before the Caribbean and strike terror into repressive regime and scruple and politicians, and now trembling in their hands. Stand up, Grenada. Nobody come in and dictate your course of action. All of them who oppose your revolution, a political band is just like here in their own island. Fight for your rights, protect what you have. You fought a good fight, protect what you have. Don't give in a single inch, don't retreat not even a pinch. Don't compromise your revolution. Scandalous people, no oppressive political scams in the Caribbean. No way, never right. The state of affairs in their land, you will find human rights violations, total disregard for the constitution, complex political persecution, and a wave of sanctioned violence, with the blessing of legislative criminals enforced by sadistic gangs, just like the Mangoose one. Stand up, Grenada! Stand up again, Grenadian! Don't let nobody come in and dictate your course of action. All of them who oppose your revolution, a political band is just like here in their own island. Fight for your rights, protect what you have. You fought a good fight now, protect what you have. Don't give in a single inch, don't retreat not even a pinch. Don't compromise your revolution, for those scandalous people, oppressive political scams. Corruption being repeated. May that rude awakening that early dawn be an example to tyrant in other lands. No power, no weapon, we can extinguish a people's hope to be free. Stand up, Grenada! Stand up again, Grenada! Don't let nobody come in and dictate your course of action. All of them who oppose your revolution, a political band is just like here in their own island. Fight for your rights. Protect what you have. You fought a good fight. Protect what you have. Don't give in a single inch. Don't retreat, not even a pinch. Don't compromise your revolution. For those scandalous people, oppressive political scams in the Caribbean. No way, never I say.
Akwaba to all of our listeners in Accra and Kumasi and Wa. You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We are paying tribute to Maurice Bishop and the Grenadian Revolution. And we were listening to King Short Shirt out of Antigua, and we heard Maurice Bishop talk about the reason, the real reason why U.S. imperialism feared the revolution in Grenada, that it was the language question was very important because Amilcar Cabral spoke Portuguese and he couldn't communicate directly with the Africans in the United States. Samora Machel spoke Portuguese, so he couldn't communicate directly. But Maurice Bishop and Jacqueline Kreff and other people spoke English and spoke English very well and could communicate directly to the African people in the United States and in Canada. And I met Maurice Bishop at the UNIA Hall in Toronto, which is on College Street. And Maurice Bishop used to help lay out the Contrast newspaper, which was an African weekly, which was put out by Al Hamilton, the late Al Hamilton. And we're going to continue with Maurice Bishop's speech, and then we're going to hear a song from The Mighty Sparrow, which had some questionable lyrics, but we can talk about that later. So this is Maurice Bishop continuing to speak at Hunter College in New York City.
But, sisters and brothers, how do we evaluate other sides of the report? Like when they say that Grenada violates human rights. When they say to us, how come you are detainees? What about the press? What about elections? When they say to us, where are your elections? They don't turn around at the same time and say to their friends in South Africa.
I want to go is only buns in the tongue. People running helter-skelter, looking for a place to shelter. Señor, por favor, la manera que tengo mi corazón. Viva, viva, viva la revolución. Digo, if Cuba had arrested God and our sin, America wouldn't have excuse to come in. Llévame a Granada, llévame. Llévame a Granada, llévame. Judas, Lucifer and Jezebel mustn't get away. General, dust to dawn, curfew on, wrong or right, shoot on sight, supported by construction workers with machine guns and rocket launchers. Señor, por favor, la manera que tengo mi corazón. Viva, viva, viva la revolución. But if Cuba had arrested Ford and Austin, America wouldn't have excuse to come in.
Llévame a Granada, llévame. Llévame a Granada, llévame.
Austin, Granada, build this court, mustn't get away.
Ni hao to all of our listeners in Beijing and all over, and the Chinese diaspora trying to learn a little Mandarin. The language is a very important thing. And George Jackson talked about learning languages. African people in North America should learn some Spanish and some French, and it's good to know a little Arabic and some African languages, many African languages, but that's another issue. And you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We're paying tribute to Maurice Bishop. And Peter Tosh was a supporter of the Grenadian Revolution. And I was told that the only time Peter Tosh did not light up his spliff, or he put out his spliff, was in Grenada, because he respected the Grenadian Revolution. But I understand that they welcomed him as comrade, and he said that he didn't come red, he came black. But comrade is a term that I like the term comrade, and I agree with Amiel Cabral. Comrade, if you are, is even higher than brotherhood or sisterhood, because your comrades fight for you and struggle. Fight with you and struggle. And we're going to listen to some more Maurice Bishop, and we're going to end this segment with Hubert Winston McIntosh, a.k.a. Walde Semayat. The world knows him as Peter Tosh. And then we're going to listen to Peter Tosh, a concert he did in Toronto, Canada. So let's go back to Maurice Bishop and listen to a little Peter Tosh, and we will be black.
In this country, 100,000 Americans in the first week of the American Revolution, 100,000 fled to Canada. Thousands were locked up without charge or trial. Hundreds were shot. And the counter-revolutionaries after the American Revolution, they had no right to vote. They had no right to teach. They had no right to preach. They had no right to a job. Their land was confiscated without payment. There is one famous counter-revolutionary family in the 1776 revolution. I remember the story well. It's the Fairfax family from Virginia. And Lord and Lady Fairfax, 2.8 million acres of their land were confiscated without 1 cent by the revolutionaries. 2.8 million acres. So when the falsifiers of history try to pretend that the American Revolution was a Boston Tea Party, was a very bloody Tea Party. The fact of the matter is, that every single time, if we are to be honest about this question, whenever revolution comes, the same questions come and face the leaders of the revolution. One question always is, what do you do with the bloody-minded murderers, the criminals, the ones who propped up the dictatorship, the ones who led to disappearances of our people, the ones who were beating the people, who were killing the people, who were crushing the heads of the youth, young people. Revolutions answer that question in different ways. Some people take them out in the streets, line them up and shoot them down. That is one answer. Some other people pretend that they went into the bush, and while they were in the bush as gorillas, they shoot them down too. Some other people create special courts to deal with them. I am not passing judgment on any of these three monkeys. What I say is that in Grenada, the Grenada Revolution did not have the appetite for any of those three monkeys. So we took what we saw as a humanitarian cause, we cleaned them and treated them well.
Assalamu alaikum to all of our Muslim listeners, and I guess some people would say some of my best friends are Muslim, but many of my family are Muslims and joined the Nation of Islam or helped build the mosque in Los Angeles, California. So, and I went to the mosque when I was 14, but I am not a Muslim. I'm a secular person, but I don't discriminate against religions, but I am secular. Let me repeat, I am a secular person. This segment is dedicated to Maurice Bishop, Unison Whiteman, Fitzroy Bain, Jacqueline Kress, Vincent Noel, and Norris Bain. They were all murdered on October 19th, 1983, and Jacqueline Kress was pregnant with Maurice Bishop's child, and Maurice Bishop had a son, Vladimir, that was killed in Toronto, Canada. As we say, October 19th is a dreadful and a great day. It was dreadful because we lost Maurice Bishop and the other people, the other comrades in Grenada. And it was a great day because Peter Tosh was born on October the 19th, 1944. And we're getting ready to listen to Peter Tosh. And Peter Tosh performed in Toronto, Canada in 1979. He had Sly and Robbie were with him, Donald Kinsey from Gary, Indiana, and the Tamlins were backing him up. And I think Herbie Miller at that time was his manager. And I met Peter Tosh in 1978 in Los Angeles, California, and I was in contact with him all until he passed away. I used to see him every time he came to Toronto, and I had the honor of touring with Peter Tosh when they toured Canada. So we're going to listen to Walde Samayat, Hubert Winston McIntosh. The world knows him as Peter Tosh. This is live in Toronto, Canada.
You have got the identity.
anything that you can do. I can do it better, cause I'm the dummy. And I can do what you won't do, and you won't try to do what I do. Stop from doing wrong and change your mood.
We're gonna need more than troubles behind. Okay, don't look back. We're gonna walk, don't look back.
Get up, stand up. Don't give up. up the fight. No preacher man don't tell me heaven is on the earth. He's a duppy and he don't know what life is really worth. Is that all that glitter is gold? How my history was never told. And now I see the light. I'm gonna rise up and stand up. Get up, stand up. Stand up, stand up. Get up and stand up. Don't you give up the fight. Get up and stand up. Stand up for your life.
Uhuru, this is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, coming to you red, black, and green, African people. Like all people, have to be concerned about the environment. And I know if Peter Tosh were still in the land of the living, he would be concerned about the environment. And I would like to thank Lisa Watson for teching today. I would like to thank John Whitford for a great interview. And remember Walde Semayat, Peter Tosh, and Maurice Bishop, and all of the comrades that were killed with him on October 13th, 1983. And we will be black next Sunday. And we're going to end with the music of John William Coltrane and Eric Dolphy. And this is our theme song. It's called The Spiritual.